Welcome to the Chariot TechCast, episode number 108. This is our interview with Core Rust team member and Philly Emerging Tech speaker, Carol Nichols. I'm TechCast producer, Becca Refford. The Chariot TechCast is brought to you by Chariot Solutions. For help developing great software, whether it's in the cloud, native apps in iOS or Android, browser-based single-page apps in React or Angular, moving big data around, or even integrating IoT devices with your data collection, services, and sensors, Chariot is here to help. We provide project-based consulting, training, mentoring, and architectural evaluations to make your efforts shine. Visit us on the web at chariotsolutions.com. Our guest for this episode is Carol Nichols. She's a Rust core team member who consults on Rust projects, provides mentoring and training, and has written both books and video content on Rust for people learning about the language. Carol's also the founder of Integer 32, the world's first Rust-focused consultancy. Visit integer32.com for more information on Rust training, prototypes, and staff augmentation services available. You can find the link to read or purchase the Rust programming language documentation, which Carol co-wrote with Steve Klabnik, in our show notes at chariotsolutions.com/podcast/Carol-Nichols-Rust. Her video series, Rust in Motion, can also be found in the show notes. Make sure to listen to the end of this podcast, where we'll tell you ways to get the videos for free or purchase Manning's books at a discount. Carol is one of our featured Philly Emerging Tech speakers on the podcast this year. You can come see her at the show. As of the time this podcast is released, tickets will still be available, but they're selling out fast. Again, at the end of the podcast, we offer a discount code for registering as a TechCast listener. We hope to see you there this year. Now, on to the TechCast with Carol.
Carol, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for inviting me to speak at Philly ET. I'm excited.
That's right. Yeah. So she's actually speaking at our Philly Emerging Technologies for the Enterprise Conference in April. And so she's talking about Rust specifically and calling it a language for the next 40 years. So before we get into the Rust topics, let's talk a little bit about you. How did you come to programming? Did you come in through like a traditional college angle, or did you learn it kind of as an adult? Like what was your start in software?
Yeah, I did major in computer science at the University of Pittsburgh. And then I had an enterprise software job for a while at a company called Bevisimo, which made an enterprise search product. The company has since been acquired by IBM. I left before they got acquired. And so at that company, I was doing a lot of XSL, actually.
Oh, yeah.
which is kind of a niche language that's really good at parsing XML and turning XML into other things like HTML, not really good for much else,
yeah.
As much as we tried.
Right.
But yeah, it's also kind of difficult to work with. My team lead snuck in Ruby to do some automated testing of our UI because we broke the UI all the time. Mm-hmm. And so automated testing made it much more of a joy to be writing that software. So like line numbers made sense again and things like that. XSL
little
doesn't really
things.
Have that. Yeah. XSL doesn't really have that in its errors, which is frustrating.
Yeah.
But yes, and then eventually we snuck in a Rails app and I really started enjoying Ruby. So I did, I went to a few Ruby jobs after that. The most recent one was at Think Through Math, a company that has a remedial math tutoring software mm-hmm. for schools. That was a lot of fun. And something I did a lot at that company was getting Rails to scale, which it is possible to do. People like to say, oh, Rails doesn't scale. It does scale. It's very individual to the way in which you need it to scale.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, the whole thing there was, you know, setting up the right number of instances and tuning your code so it's not overly, you know, painful to a given instance, I guess, and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah. And making sure your queries aren't taking a long time. And we did things like move to a data warehouse because we had a lot of reports to generate. Mm-hmm. So we had to create like basically two different databases, one that was good for writing to and then one that was good for reading queries from. That was fun. So a lot of my time was spent trying to get Rails and Ruby to be faster. And at some point, to really get Ruby to be faster, you have to drop into C. And I am terrified of C. I should be nowhere near production C. It's just,
Most of it should be nowhere near production, exactly, in my opinion.
Yeah.
It's too dangerous.
Yes.
And hard.
That is one of the points of my talk, is that sea is dangerous, and we as an industry are being irresponsible for our users by continuing to use sea, knowing how dangerous it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So that might be a little controversial.
We'll go with it.
Around that time was when I became aware of Rust, and it was perfect for where I was in my career and where I wanted to go and not do C. It's because Rust lets you get lower level performance while writing with higher level constructs. It has some functional influences, and it has a bunch of memory safety protections built into the language so that your code won't even compile if you have certain classes of problems in your code. So it's not nearly as dangerous as C. It solves the mistakes that we've made in C over and over and over again. So I really feel like Rust is a step forward in the industry that is a much more responsible choice than C at this point. And my talk is going to have a lot of caveats in it, because I can hear the objections to what I'm saying already.
Sure.
Things like, are you saying we should rewrite everything in C in Rust? And no, I am very aware of legacy code in the enterprise making money for your company, and that if you take a lot of time to stop and rewrites are always risky. You should be very, very have thought a lot before embarking on a rewrite. But there are ways to rewrite parts of your software in Rust, and because Rust has a CFFI. So you can rewrite just the parts that crash the most, or just the parts that change the most. And you can get those benefits of Rust without doing a full rewrite of your software.
That's really compelling, because, I mean, if you got, like, let's say an area where it's heavily threaded, for example, and the threading code is written with race conditions and all sorts of things in it. I'm assuming that's the kind of stuff that Rust can help you find, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. All right, so you have this ability, as you're starting to work with Rust, you're able to, you know, kind of take a little bit of something and work Rust into it. Did you end up doing that with the Ruby code when you dropped down to C? Did you drop down to Rust compatible with C, or you just kind of took a branch off and started looking at Rust?
I took my career in a branch and started looking at Rust. So I didn't get a chance to implement anything in Rust at Think Through Math. But the biggest case of this is Firefox. And Rust is a Mozilla project. They employ a lot of the people working on Rust full time. But we do have our own independent governance and direction. It's not only a Mozilla project. But Mozilla is slowly taking pieces of Firefox and rewriting them in Rust to get better performance, more multi-threaded parts, and as a side benefit, becoming more secure, because a lot of the memory safety problems they had in C and C++ became possible venues for exploits. And a great article, I will send you a link to this, a great article just came out today about how Firefox's quantum CSS rendering, which has been rerun in Rust, they did an analysis of the bugs that were in the CSS renderer when it was in C++ and whether Rust would have prevented them. And it was something like 76%.
Wow.
Rust. Yeah.
So huge improvements just from switching to Rust from C. It just would identify a whole like class of things you couldn't easily see and get visibility into.
Yes.
And you're saying a lot of that's compiler driven?
Right. Yes.
That's really cool. So you find out like right away you can't even run the code.
Yes. A lot of it is compiler driven. There are the array bounds checks are at runtime, but a lot of the it's ownership and borrowing is what it's called in Rust, is preventing dangling references, dangling pointers, preventing use after free. Those kind of bugs are caught at compile time.
That's pretty cool. We had Steve Klabnik on a long time ago.
Yeah.
2016, and he was mentioning something about like some of the real voodoo and some of the more interesting deeper dives into things that were in this book he had been maintaining called the Rustamonicon. Is that thing still around?
Or
is that
kind
of that's it?
Yeah.
Like the Necronomicon. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So, that thing's still around. Are you guys still updating that, or did that kind of make its way into the main docks?
It is still around. It is still a separate thing because it mm-hmm. is kind of exploring how Rust is implemented.
Like internals and things.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So it's definitely not something you need to understand to be able to program in Rust. It's useful if you want to implement your own data structures in Rust. And mm-hmm. so a caveat is that Rust does have this keyword unsafe, which lets you dereference a raw pointer and do a couple of other things. It doesn't let you turn off what's called the borrow checker, and we can get into what that is. It doesn't let you turn off all of Rust's safety checks, but it lets you dereference a raw pointer, which is potentially a source of bugs in your code that you can't do in regular Rust. But mm-hmm. so you can opt out of some of these checks for reasons of performance or because that Rust doesn't understand that what you're trying to do is actually okay. That could mm-hmm. because its static analysis is really conservative. So there are some times where what you're doing is actually fine, but Rust can't understand that. So there is this unsafe keyword, which doesn't mean that what you're doing is actually unsafe. It's that it might be unsafe, and you mm-hmm. as the human are ensuring that you have verified that it's fine. Which has the benefit of if your program crashes with a seg fault, then you have a much smaller amount of code that you have to review. You know it's in an unsafe block somewhere. Right. And now as long as you haven't put your entire program in an unsafe block,
right.
then you have a head start on debugging that. Whereas in C, everything is unsafe.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems like it's a language that makes what you would do in C a lot more predictable.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let me ask you a question then. So you're talking about you've got higher level constructs, right? So I think, okay, in my brain, Java developer here goes, okay, I program in a high level language. I'm stuck with a VM,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all the things that come with a VM and the tuning and the memory limits and things like that. And, you know, the threading model is Java threads, which usually push off the operating system, but they're controlled by Java. What kinds of things that you would normally do is, let's say, a Java or Ruby programmer, Rails programmer, let's say, how much of that can you do in Rust right now? Or is that the wrong tool to apply yet? Is it still a low level, or is it really something you can do fully fledged, you know, higher level applications in?
That is a really interesting question. There is not yet like a Rails for Rust. There's not yet a full web application framework that lets you know, write up a CRUD web app for your startup in 15 minutes or whatever. So it's not that high level yet. There are people working on pieces of that sort of thing. One piece is called Diesel, which is kind of like Active Record. It's an ORM written in Rust that it's actually aiming to make invalid SQL like a compile time error. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of neat. But there's definitely like three or four web frameworks out there right now. And each of them, they're all kind of in progress and in various states of production readiness. So I wouldn't recommend going for Rust for a fully featured web app just yet. But it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
The community is working on getting there. Where we think Rust shines today is like high performance server backend kind of things. So for like an API that didn't have a front end, we think you can get. So crates.io is Rust's package registry, kind of like npmjs.com or rubygems.org.
You said crates.io?
Yeah.
Is that it?
And I'm a maintainer on that, and its backend is written in Rust. So it has kind of an ad hoc framework that I think crates.io is the only one using, but it's a production service that is doing really well. And like it uses very little memory, very little CPU, and could scale easily beyond what we're currently getting, which is very different from the Rails app that I was used to seeing. Like it's just using a tiny amount of memory compared to that. So that's a really exciting thing to see for me, that without spending lots of time tuning garbage collectors and having that always running, without having a JVM, that you're able to get high performance. So that's one area. Another area that we're looking at is command line applications. And we think Rust really shines there because we have really good cross-compiling support. Whereas in Ruby, if you wanted to share a command line, you're developing on macOS and you wanted to share your command line tool with someone on Windows, it's really hard to, like, there's no compiling in Ruby. So person has to have Ruby on their machine. There's differences in the platforms. There's not really a way to, like, package your Ruby script into a little binary that you can just, like, share around. There is in Rust. You can cross-compile to a bunch of different platforms. The libraries that help you write really good interfaces for your command line apps are getting a lot of attention right now. And you get a really fast little command line app out of it. So that's another area we think is great today. Embedded is another situation that we're giving a lot of attention right now. And while there are processors that Rust doesn't support, so Rust uses LLVM as a backend. So there are a whole bunch of platforms that basically have their own C compiler, and we don't support every single one of those. But there are a lot of common boards and processors that we do support. And because of the low resource usage that Rust has, and there's a way to compile Rust without the standard library, so we think it's a great use in the embedded context as well.
And then I see WebAssembly stuff.
Yes. So WebAssembly is this new way of writing code for the web that's kind of lower level JavaScript in a way. I'm not an expert in WebAssembly, but Rust is one of the languages that can target WebAssembly. It's similar to assembly in that you can't do memory allocation. You can't have a garbage collector. And this is an area where there isn't legacy code. So it's really exciting that we have an opportunity to start with something better. So I think there's a lot of really exciting WebAssembly stuff that's going to be starting to happen. And Rust is going to be helping with that.
Is the Mozilla team focusing some people around that on the Rust side to, you know, kind of shore up their implementation by testing against Firefox and things like that? Or
yes, there are definitely collaborations between the Firefox team and the Rust team focused on WebAssembly.
Cool. Really neat. So, all right, I have to ask you this question next. So you're out there in the other, as you put it, the other city with a P in Pennsylvania, which I wonder if that's Pittsburgh.
It is indeed.
Since you said you graduated from there. So you know, Gritty can't drive that far, so you're safe. But
perfect.
So all right, so we've got this, you know, work being done in Rust. How are you doing in Rust consulting out there? Are you finding that there's work to be had full-time in doing Rust work?
So a lot of companies are experimenting in Rust alongside of what they already have. So often their internal developers that they already have are partially using Rust. So we've done some prototypes, and blockchain is another area that people are using Rust in a lot. There's a Parity Ethereum client is written in Rust. And one of the jobs we had was there are people researching how to switch Bitcoin from proof of work to proof of stake, where people who have the most Bitcoin would be the ones deciding which transactions are valid or not and processing the blockchain. And we worked with a company who had an implementation of an algorithm in Haskell, and another company had a different algorithm that they implemented as a Parity plugin. So the company that had the Haskell implementation contracted with us to implement their algorithm in Parity so that they could do kind of an apples to apples comparison on performance and things like that. So that was really interesting. And we do a lot of, we can do training. We've done some training things. Right now, what we're working mostly on is the Rust in Motion video course for Manning. And I'm also the co-author with Steve Klavnik on the Rust programming language book, which is available in print from No Starch Press and available online for free to read. And that is aiming to be kind of a comprehensive-ish. There are definitely some things that are, as we mentioned, are in the Nomicon and not in the main book. But the book is trying to give you everything you might need to get up and running in Rust. The video series, in contrast, Rust in Motion, we are trying to, what I've seen a lot happen when people try and learn Rust is there are people who feel like they're really good at picking up new programming languages. You kind of skim the docs a little bit, you start writing some code, and you just have to figure out where the syntax differences are, look up some of the standard library functions, and you're off and running and you can go forth and make things. And when these folks try and pick up Rust, they start using the same methods that they have before, and they run full speed into a brick wall, and they kind of freak out and are like, I don't understand what's happening. I can't get my code to compile. I'm not sure what's going on. I thought I was good at learning programming languages. I don't understand. And the problem here is that Rust has a few core ideas that are really different than most other programming languages. And I really think you can't just dive in without understanding these really core differences. So that's in the video course, is trying to concentrate just on those important differences, so that then you can go back to what you're used to doing, is just checking the docs when you need to, once you know these really core important things. So the four things we cover in the video series, we have a unit on kind of the parts that are different about the basic syntax. There are things like variables are immutable by default in Rust. So things like that can trip you up right away. So the basic syntax differences. The next unit is on ownership and borrowing. And that's the most important big difference, is how this is the mechanism by which Rust ensures your memory safe. And it does mean that you sometimes need to structure your code differently than you're used to, because Rust ensures that there's only ever one owner of a piece of data, and that owner is responsible for cleaning it up. And then you can have immutable borrows where you can just read that data, and you have mutable borrows that are allowed to change that data. And there are restrictions on when in your code you're allowed to have immutable or mutable borrows. So something like this is something the Nomicon covered. There's another tutorial called Learning Rust by Writing Too Many Linked Lists. And I will give you a link to that for the show notes.
That's fantastic. Yep.
A linked list is actually a really hard data structure to get right. And this is another, a lot of people are like, oh, okay, I'm going to re-implement my favorite data structure in this new language. And so this is like the first thing they try in Rust, and it's terrible.
It's the worst choice to make. Yeah, right.
Absolutely terrible. Please do not start learning Rust by trying to write a linked list.
Note to self.
You'll have a bad time. And there are reasons for that. There are lots of unsafe things that can happen in a linked list, and Rust doesn't let you do any of them. So it can be really frustrating. But especially if you don't have a really good mental model for how this ownership and borrowing stuff works. So that's the second unit. The third unit is on error handling. There aren't exceptions in Rust. There's a result type, which is a value that will contain either the successful value or an error value. And there's also an option type, which can either be something or nothing. Mm-hmm. So because Rust is trying to be so safe, it tries to help you acknowledge when your code might fail and make sure that you handle that failure appropriately, rather than crashing or having a null pointer or other problems like that. So the error handling is different than a lot of other languages. It does have some similarities with Haskell and a little bit of similarity with Go, but it felt a lot different than, say, Ruby to me, because Ruby, you just throw and catch exceptions all over the place and it kind of gets unwieldy. But Rust really, I really like the way Rust handles errors. And then the fourth unit is on lifetimes, which is kind of part of the ownership and borrowing system. You can actually get a really long way in Rust without encountering lifetimes, but there's like tick A's, which is a generic lifetime parameter that you might see reading other people's code, or you might see in error messages, and it's the syntax looks weird. The concept again is really different. So even though it's not the most common thing, but it's one of those concepts that helps to understand it, so that when you do encounter it, it's not a scary stop the world thing in your programming.
Thinking, yeah.
It's something that you can go, oh, okay, I remember this. Mm-hmm. I know where to look to, or I have strategies to solve this. I'm not going to freak out. And yeah. So that's what our video course is all about. It's not everything you might want to know about Rust, but it's meant to kind of complement resources like the Rust programming language book.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, and then the Rust programming language book that you said there's no starch press was for the, if you want to get a PDF or printable copy, you could do that for a fee, but also it's online as well, right? Just directly, if you want to click through it and read it, you can access it directly without paying for
exactly.
it as you're learning. Okay. And so as people are getting started learning, let's talk a little bit about tooling. So I know there's like a nice getting started section and, you know, pick the right platform and install the tools. Mm-hmm. What are the developer tools you typically use for writing Rust? I mean, are there tools like Visual Studio or, you know, IntelliJ, that kind of thing? Or are people doing Vim, plain old Vim with plugins? Sounds like you could, certainly.
Yeah.
But like, what do you see people using the most?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks are doing kind of the plain Vim experience. I'm a TextMate user. I kind of got stuck on that, mm-hmm. and that's where I'm most comfortable. But there are, so there's the RLS, which is the Rust language server, which conforms to this language server protocol. And it's still in development. There's still a lot of work to be done, but there is a VS Code plugin that uses the RLS and provides things like autocomplete, jump to definition, documentation, integration. Cool. And there is a separate IntelliJ plugin that I don't think is using the RLS, but it's also under development right now. But making the IDE experience better is something we've been focused on in the last year and will continue to be a focus. We definitely understand that that's an important thing. I'm really excited for when we get to some of the more refactoring tools. I don't mm-hmm. think we have those yet, but one of my favorite books is Working Effectively with Legacy Code by Michael Feathers.
Yep. Oh, Feathers, love yeah, it. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Love yep. that book so much. And but a lot of, so he's talking a lot about compiled language that has a lot of, he talks about leaning on the compiler and leaning on your tools a lot and using automatic refactoring through your IDE. And in Ruby, that's basically impossible to do things like renaming a method when you can like dynamically call a method by using a string. There's no way. There is no tool that can ensure that you've gotten every single spot that might call that method. So,
you know, it's funny to jump in there for a second. So like we're a consulting firm. We've been around for, 15 years now total. And we're, you know, we've gone through all the different waves that are out there. So we went through the Java EE wave mm-hmm. to the Spring wave to the, and in the middle of the whole Java Spring wave, we had kind of the insurgency plan of the insurgents with Ruby and Rails. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of projects that started with that. And what I think sunk Rails long term for the enterprise is the fact that it's so dynamic. The projects fire up so quickly and die so quickly out there on the internets mm-hmm. that like you're in the middle of looking at something you worked on 2 years ago when you try to do an update and everything's broken.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's really and I find the same problem. I'm having the same problem now with like React and Angular and things mm-hmm. like that. Like mm-hmm. that there's just people are so willing to just build a project in 3 minutes, put it out there, call it an official name, and then assume people are going to wire it in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's speaking to that problem, like types are good, design is good.
Yeah.
There should be a backlash, which is why a lot of people like TypeScript, I think, in the JavaScript world. You know, it's the same thing. But that's good to know that like you guys are working on tooling for that to really kind of help. I like that book. I think when I saw Michael Feathers talk about it, it might have been at ETE, but when he was talking about this stuff, he was saying, you know, it's kind of like if you don't have any tests against your code, maybe it wasn't him, but I remember this talk. That, you know, if you're going to refactor code, you better have some tests written and good compiling tools, because otherwise it's like sticking a screwdriver in a power panel and hoping you don't shock yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to see that you guys are making progress with that and moving forward, especially with that Rust language server. I'm sure that's going to enable a lot of those features.
But that kind of leads me into the title of my talk, I think.
Yeah, let's do that.
And because I really think Rust, we're in it for the long term. And this, again, is going to be one of my caveats in my talk, is that maybe we won't last 4 years. Maybe we won't catch on as much as C has. But we're preparing for that possibility. And we're not, one of our little sayings is stability without stagnation. We do a release every 6 weeks, but we have really strong backwards compatibility guarantees. so that you don't have to be scared of updating your compiler. If you write, if you had any code that you wrote with Rust 1.0, you should be able to update your compiler to, I think, Rust 1.33 is coming out today, February 28th when we're recording this. You should be able to update to Rust 1.33 and still be able to compile that code without needing to update it. There are some caveats to that. If we discover a soundness issue, we're going to fix that. But we're really trying to support that case you were talking about of picking a project back up and needing to make changes to it when everything around you has changed. We want to enable that code to keep compiling.
You know, with the Java world, that's one of the reasons Java's been around for 20 years is the JDK will deprecate things, but they'll never remove them completely.
Right. Yeah.
So you could run terrible code written in, 1997, but you don't need to. But you don't break everything by going to, Java 6 or Java 7.
Right.
Which, that's the right side of programming history to be on, in my opinion.
Yeah. So something I'm going to get into in my talk is we have this concept of additions, which is an opt-in way for us to do things like introduce new keywords, which is a breaking change. It's a very limited amount of breakage that we are enabling ourselves to make in the language, but it's opt-in. So if you don't change your addition, you can still upgrade your compiler and your code will still work. If you choose to update your addition, this is another developer tool. We have a tool called RustFix that will automatically update your code to the new. We introduced some new idioms. We made some improvements.
Cool.
And this RustFix tool will automatically apply as much as it can to get you onto the new edition. So this gives us a way to evolve and not stay the same with the same mistakes that we've had forever, but also to keep old code compiling and to let you opt in when you have time to update your code, not when we decide you should update your code. So
that's a really good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we recently released our first edition, the Rust 2018 edition. I want to get into the mechanism of that and why it makes Rust a good choice going forward in my talk.
Oh, that's fantastic. Okay. Yeah. See, you're really getting me interested in that. I know we've got some developers, if I remember correctly, there's some people doing things like data processing, ETL processing tools and command line tools and automation tools in Rust.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the last couple of people I've been talking to and even interviewing are really getting passionate about Rust and enjoying it. So it's definitely, it's making the rounds and becoming more kind of in the background here, but it seems like you guys are really focused on the long haul and you're focused on, a language that can be used like C, but can be used like C without all the tears, so to speak.
Yes, that is,
which is really
that is
great.
Our hope. And yeah, I'm totally open to something better than Rust coming out and making it so that we don't last 4 years. That would be amazing as well. But I just want,
that's progress,
I want the
yeah.
industry mm-hmm. to move forward. I want us to stop using C. So I think Rust is the way to get there. If someone comes up with better ideas, I'm open to that too.
Mm-hmm.
But let's stop making the same mistakes over and over again. Let's make some new mistakes.
That sounds like a plan. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll put this stuff up. You can go to chariotsolutions.com/techcast, which is where our podcasts are, and you'll see the show notes for this episode. And we'll put all the links in that we're talking about. We'll put some discount code in there for you to get a copy of some of this stuff. The TechCast has just recently has a sponsor in Manning, so they have a code for us to use as well. And Carol, we're looking forward to your talk. We're really looking forward to seeing it at ETE.
I'm excited too.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Carol Nichols for podcasting with us on this episode. It's number 108, and the show notes are available online at chariotsolutions.com/techcast. Remember, if you're attending Philly Emerging Tech this year, she's talking about Rust there. Her talk is entitled Rust, a Programming Language for the Next 40 Years. Pretty provocative title. Find out what she means by attending the talk. If you haven't registered for Philly Emerging Tech, you should definitely act quickly. You can use the TechCast-only discount code PODCAST19, that's all lowercase, when registering and save $75. But hurry, this code is only for the first 20 listeners who use it. The TechCast is also sponsored by Manning Publications. Chariot and Manning go way back. Many of our Philly Emerging Tech speakers are Manning authors, and several charioteers have reviewed Manning books for technical accuracy. Their In Action series is a great way to level up quickly in a given technology. That's why Manning has teamed up with Chariot to offer a discount code to TechCast listeners. Simply check out with the code PODCHARIOT19. That's PODCHARIOT, all lowercase, and the number 19, and you'll get a whopping 40% off your next purchase. This discount is good for all TechCast listeners. For this podcast only, Manning and our guest Carol Nichols are providing several codes for a free copy of her video course, Rust in Motion. Here's what you have to do to get it. First, follow Chariot Solutions on Twitter. We're at Chariot Solution, without the S. Next, tweet something you liked about this episode on Rust with Carol. Be one of the first 8 to do it, and we'll follow you back and award you the code. That's all you have to do. That's it for this TechCast, hosted by Ken Rimple and produced by myself, Becca Rufford. Until next time.